This is the tax update for July the 28th, 2008. This week, heating warnings. Taxpayer penalized at the preparer shopping. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in plain tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and determine its raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use includes using the podcast or documents part of a CPU presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. This week, we're going to take a look at the case of Wadsworth v. Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2008-171. And given all the interest that's arisen in the area of tax return positions, penalties, and competent authority, I found this case interesting because it deals with both how a taxpayer and the tax preparer reacted to an issue where a taxpayer wanted a position taken, and the tax preparer came to the conclusion that that position was not supported by authority, as well as the court's view when that taxpayer then decided to fire the tax preparer and go out and find somebody else who would do the return the way he wanted it done. That's the very sort of situation that some of us find ourselves put in when we have to give answers to clients that they don't like to hear. This case deals with client reliance on professionals, disclosed positions, and even discusses in commentary that really didn't directly impact the decision, on the idea of what the reasonable basis standard would be for the tax position in question. Now, in the case in question, the taxpayers were potentially going to be forced to reimburse the state of California for alleged significant overpayments to their pharmacy business for products and services provided to beneficiaries of the California Medical Assistance Programs. Now, while the taxpayers continued to dispute that assessment that the state of California was trying to make against them for overpayments that they had paid to them for their pharmacy services and products, they wanted to amend their return for the years in which they received the payments to claim a refund to exclude those deemed overpayments, or what the state of California was claiming were overpayments, from their income for the year in question. When their longtime CPA refused to amend the returns after concluding there was no support under the law for such a claim for refund, the taxpayers, at the urging of their attorney, went to another preparer who was representing them, at the urging of the attorneys representing them in the claim with the state of California, went to another preparer who prepared the refund claim for them. The good news was that eventually the taxpayers prevailed in their case versus the state of California and didn't have to pay back a significant amount of money to the state for as overpayments for amounts received in their pharmacy business. But the bad news was that the IRS came back later and looked to collect back the refunds it had originally paid based on their claims and apply the penalties for a substantial underpayment of tax. As we noted, the issue first arose when the State of California Department of Health Services decided to audit the taxpayer's pharmacy business, Gold Coast Medical Services, referred to in the case as GCMS, for payments made to beneficiaries of the California Medical Assistance Programs during the years 2001 and 2002. GCMS was a partnership, and Larry Wadsworth was the general partner. At the conclusion of the state of California's examination of the payments made to his pharmacy, or the partnership's pharmacy, on August 19, 2003, the tax court noted the following results from the initial exam. DHS concluded that GCMS had been overpaid for those periods and directed GCMS to remiss $2,311,634.39 within 60 days of the issuance of the audit report, or be subject to interest and an offset of 100% withholding on the current billings. Now, as you might guess, that was a bit of a shock to the taxpayer, who was going to have to write a check back to the state of California for over $2 million. Faced with that, the taxpayer, of course, wanted some tax benefit, saying, well, if I had to, you know, I picked that up in income, I've already paid tax to you and the IRS for this amount, the state of California and to the IRS, therefore, I should be able to go back and exclude that, is the taxpayer's thought. Now, GCMS did not agree with those findings, though, and contested the audit report. $2.3 million in play you can afford to contest for a while. In the end, GCMS prevailed in its position, and no overpayments had been made to it, essentially, and therefore didn't have to repay those amounts to the state of California. The tax court note, the DHS Office of Administrative Hearings and Appeals concluded on September 7, 2004, just a little over a year after the original audit report, that GCMS did not engage in discriminatory billings and had not been overpaid. Consequently, GCMS made no reimbursement payments to DHS. Now, while that was a good result for the taxpayers, things didn't go quite as well for Mr. and Mrs. Wadsworth with regard to the tax positions they took in response to this contingent liability at the partnership's level. When DHS proposed that the taxpayer repay $2.3 million, the taxpayer and their attorney, Robert Rothstein, contacted the Wadsworth longtime tax CPA, Keith Borges, to see if they could prepare amended partnership tax returns to reduce the partnership's income for the year in question by the contingent liability, and of course, then amend the partner's individual tax returns to claim refunds for overpaid tax. Now, the tax court discussed Mr. Borges's qualifications as follows. Noted he had prepared the petitioner's return since 1994. He received a Bachelor of Science degree with an emphasis in accounting in 1979, and had been an accountant ever since. He had been a certified public accountant since 1981 and was a partner in the accounting firm of Anderson, Lucas, Somerville, and Borges. He's a member of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the California Society of Certified Public Accountants. Mr. Borges took this request from the client under consideration and hit the books to see if a deduction was going to be justified. He concluded that, under the law and authorities, there was no support for claiming such a deduction, and he informed the taxpayer and their attorneys of his findings. The court also noted that he requested that Mr. Rothstein, who was the attorney, send him any supporting information or legal authority to justify claiming a deduction for this contingent liability. Mr. Borges never received any additional information. What did happen was, essentially, everything had gone according to the book up to this point. The taxpayer had gone to the CPA and said, you know, I think I've got this $2.3 million the state of California wants me to pay back. I paid taxes on it in those 2 years. Can I go back, reduce my taxes? The CPA went and researched the law, came back to the client, and gave him the conclusion that, in fact, he had concluded there was no authority to do so. But not claiming that he is infallible, he suggested that if the attorney representing them had some other authority that would justify the deduction, he'd like to know about it. You know, give me your sources and we'll go from there. Most important for CPAs to note is that Mr. Borges did not subordinate his judgment to that of the other professional, in this case, the attorney in the case. That is prohibited by the Code of Professional Ethics Rule 102. But he also did not presume that his research was infallible. He asked for support. That is basically the step that should be taken by not only CPAs, but any tax professional faced with this problem. At this point, the taxpayer and his attorney advisor, go off course. And per the tax court, reacts not by coming up with information to support the deduction, but rather went in search of a preparer who would prepare the claim for refund. The court notes that the taxpayer and Mr. Rothstein went to Douglas Huff to do the amended return. The court very tersely summarizes Mr. Huff's qualifications as follows, that he had a background in finance and had been preparing returns for Mr. Rothstein's clients for some time. Note, historically, when we talk about the issue about reliance on a professional, it's never been good to have the court refer to referral relationships or a presumption that, in fact, this person became the advisor basically because he would give the answer that some party in interest wanted the answer to be. And that seems to be the presumption the court brings here by noting that Mr. Rothstein had this gentleman prepare returns for his clients in the past. The court also gave a less than flattering explanation of what Mr. Huff did to make his determination about whether this claim was valid. He amended the GCMS returns after discussion with Mr. Rothstein, but without consulting tax cases or any other information. Mr. Huff had several conversations with Mr. Rothstein about the amended return because Mr. Borge's refusal to amend the return concerned Mr. Huff, yet he went ahead with amending the returns. Mr. Huff described Mr. Rothstein as a bankruptcy-slash-tax attorney who had been preparing returns for many years. Mr. Huff amended the petitioner's return based on what he described as a possible contingent liability. A number of factors jump out from that description. Clearly, it appears the court believed Mr. Huff's ultimate justification was that he did it because he relied upon the attorney, primarily based upon the fact that the attorney presumably is an attorney and he'd been preparing returns for years. Now, that's an interesting thing to say about somebody who isn't preparing the very amended return that he's trying to get you to prepare. It's like, I rely upon this guy because I know he's prepared returns for years, but then why isn't he doing this one? Interesting aside, but Mr. Huff believed that Mr. Rothstein had this background. He also was concerned about Mr. Borge's refusal to amend the returns, but he apparently took no research to uncover why Mr. Borges had these concerns, but rather simply asked the attorney, who had been the person that had decided apparently in response to Mr. Borges's claim that the deduction was not allowed, to go shopping for sub-preparer who would accept that position. He apparently, Mr. Huff, took comfort in Mr. Rothstein's implied determination that the deduction was proper, and that's why Mr. Borges, it had been his advice to dismiss Mr. Borges and go looking and bring in his normal preparer. The amended returns were filed before the taxpayers prevailed in the appeal of the DHS audit report. Those amended returns claimed for these taxpayers in question a refund of $147,708 for 2001, and $56,958 for 2002. The claims were paid by the IRS. Now, after paying the refunds, the IRS decided to examine the returns for the year in question. The IRS eventually assessed the taxpayers to get the refunds back, plus demanded payments of penalties for substantial understatement of tax under Section 6662B2 for 2001 and 2002. Those claims for refund exceeded the threshold under 6662D1A for application of the penalty. In essence, the amount the IRS was assessing to get back was greater than the limitations that trigger the substantial understatement penalty. Taxpayers argued they were not subject to the penalty on a number of different provisions. Primarily, they argued that they had disclosed the position and a reasonable basis for the treatment, qualifying for the exception under Section 6662D2B. They also tried to argue that because their refund claim as a refund claim did not trigger the application of 6662, since the original return had reported the correct tax, is what the IRS was adjusting back to. Let's first deal with the disclosure question. The taxpayers had attached the revised Form K-1 to their claim for refund, and they argued that this revised K-1 provided the IRS with disclosure about the nature of their claim for refund, such that the IRS should not be able to impose a penalty for substantial underpayment. The court noted they did not attach Form 8275, nor did they otherwise explain the basis of the changes that were taken by the partnership when they amended their personal return. They merely attached a changed K-1 and said, "We're amending our return, apparently, because we have a revised K-1 from the partnership." The tax court did not find this to be adequate disclosure. The court notes, no accuracy related penalty may be imposed for a substantial understatement of income tax, however, when the taxpayer adequately discloses the information, discloses relevant facts affecting the tax treatment of item, and there existed a reasonable basis for the treatment of that item. A taxpayer may disclose on a Form 8275, a disclosure statement, an 8275R regulation disclosure statement, or on the return itself. The commissioner has prescribed other circumstances in which information provided on the return is adequate. A Schedule K-1 is not listed as a proper form for disclosure. The tax court holds essentially that the position was not properly disclosed, and therefore the taxpayers could not avail themselves of the disclosure provision. But then it goes on beyond that, and for a matter that's of interest to us now because we now live with a reasonable basis standard on the preparer penalty. And the court goes on to note that even if it accepted the position had been disclosed, it found that the position did not have a reasonable basis, and the taxpayer should have been aware of that fact. The tax court notes to begin the analysis that disclosure will not have an effect, moreover, where the position on the return has no reasonable basis. The reasonable basis standard is not satisfied by a return position that is merely arguable. Those quotations come essentially or are paraphrases of what we find in the regulations under 6662-3 regulation and 6662-4. The court then notes that even at trial, it did not find a coherent explanation of why there should be authoritative support sufficient to give a reasonable basis to the taxpayer's position that they could exclude those amounts from income in the years in question. The court explains, petitioners essentially argued that they elected the modified cash basis of accounting, yet failed to explain what that is or how it absolves them from the penalty. The partnership, if on the cash basis of accounting, would have been entitled to a deduction for a liability to the state of California for the year in which the liability was paid. They presented no evidence the partnership had paid any portion of the $2.3 million during 2001 or 2002 to the state of California. Nor was the partnership entitled to a deduction for returns and allowances in 2001 or 2002 under the accrual method of counting. An accrual basis taxpayer generally cannot accrue a deduction for a contested liability unless the conditions of Section 461F are met. The partnership contested DHS's report and made no transfer within the meaning of Section 461F to provide for satisfaction of the liability. An accrual method taxpayer who fails to satisfy the conditions of Section 461F ordinarily is not entitled to claim a deduction for a contested liability before the year in which the contest is eliminated by compromise or settlement or through a final disposition. We find the petitioners had no reasonable basis for their position, and accordingly, the adequate disclosure exception does not apply. Thus, the court effectively held, even if a Form 8275, 8275R, or any of the other methods of disclosure had in fact been taken on this return and adequately disclosed what we were doing, the fact the position had no reasonable basis would have eliminated their ability to get out of this penalty. Now remember, under the revised Section 6694 the preparers now work under, that means a taxpayer's preparer could not sign the return without being subject to penalty because there was no reasonable basis to support this position. The real negative in this case for the preparer who finally prepared the return was that it appears he had no authoritative backing to support the position he was claiming on the return. Rather, he seemed to have, by implication, presumed that, well, that authority must exist because the client's attorney is telling me this is a position we should be able to take to go back and get those returns, but he never asked what that authority was, and it turns out no one ever seemed to have found that authority. Whether Mr. Huff's reliance on Mr. Rothstein would have insulated him under the reasonable basis standard is open to question for 6694, because somebody who reasonably believed it was more likely than not can get out from the standard or reasonably believe the position. The problem we've got here is that I have problems deciding, especially since Mr. Huff was aware that the prior CPA had refused to amend the return and was aware that he had shed real issues, and he took no steps to independently come to a conclusion as to why the other tax professional had disagreed with the conclusion of Mr. Rothstein. In fact, didn't even make serious inquiries about why Mr. Rothstein had that position. He just knew it was a position Mr. Rothstein had. I suspect he might have had trouble had an assessment been made under 6694. But what about the fact it's an amended return? The fact the position was outlined on an amended return did not exempt it from coverage. The court noted that since it involved a recalculation of the taxpayer's tax liabilities, it was a rebate under Section 6211B2, and as such was subject to all the penalty provisions found in Section 6211 through 6216. The taxpayer still had one more possibility to escape the penalty. If they could show they had a reasonable cause for the understatement and had acted in good faith, they could avoid the penalty. Normally, this is the out taxpayers get by saying they had reasonable reliance on a professional who they had reason to believe was competent to come to a conclusion on the matter. The taxpayers claim to have relied upon Mr. Huff and Mr. Rothstein for the return positions. And it's pretty clear ultimately they did. However, the key question was whether the reliance was reasonable given the facts as known. Court notes the general rule for reliance on a professional to escape penalties by a taxpayer. Reliance on the advice of a tax professional advisor constitutes reasonable cause in good faith if, under all the circumstances, such reliance was reasonable and the taxpayer acted in good faith. To prove reasonable cause due to reliance on the advice of a tax advisor, however, the taxpayer must show the advisor was a competent professional with sufficient expertise to justify reliance. That quote is referenced back to the neonatology case you may remember from 2000, where the tax court was not happy because the taxpayers in that case had relied upon advice received by the person who was setting up the particular transaction that was involved and who benefited only if the taxpayers went through with the transaction in question. A real problem that the Wadsworth faced is that they knew a disagreement existed on whether or not the position was justified under the law. Now that's fine, you know, somebody, it could have been that in fact Mr. Borges was simply wrong. That is a possibility. But the problem is how the Wadsworth went about resolving that problem. While they aren't required to be tax experts or learn enough about the law to conclude the proper answer between what was offered up by Mr. Borges and that offered up by Mr. Rothstein and Mr. Huff, they had to show they acted reasonably in determining the qualifications of those they did rely upon, and in a case like this, have to satisfy the court that they weren't merely looking for who gave them the advice that would give them the lowest tax bill. That is, they weren't opinion shopping. The court notes that they clearly were aware there was a significant dispute. The court agrees with the IRS that the petitioners lacked reasonable cause for and failed to act in good faith with respect to their substantial understatements of income tax for 2001 and 2002. They made very little effort to assess their proper tax liability, and they failed to heed the advice of their longtime return preparer, Mr. Borges. The petitioners ignored Mr. Borges' advice, and Mr. Huff amended the returns instead. We find that Mr. Borges' refusal to amend the return should have raised a red flag for petitioners, but petitioners disregarded that warning. While the court does not say so, it seems likely that Mr. Borges understood that the failure to accommodate the position that Mr. Rothstein was advancing could cost him the client. In fact, did seem to cost him the client since they went to somebody else to get the claim prepared. It does not seem unreasonable that the client should also consider that fact in understanding that the advisor likely is not refusing to cooperate simply on a whim, but rather has run into an issue that he feels professionally keeps him from being able to sign that return, and that he feels the position really is that flaky and that far out in left field, that it would not be in the taxpayer's interest to take the position, that there simply is no support, and if challenged, this is going to fall down. We do not know what exactly Mr. Borges told his clients on this matter. If faced with such a matter, it does seem advisable for the professional to outline in detail the fact that in order to take a position where he cannot prepare the return, even with disclosure, the preparer had to come to the conclusion the position had so little support that there's not even a reasonable basis of prevailing, or back in this time period, in fact, had so little support to make it a frivolous position. While the taxpayer, under these rules in place at the time, would face penalties if there was no reasonable basis for the position, a preparer could still prepare the return with disclosure if the position was not frivolous. Does that mean the taxpayers are stuck once told this, even if the preparer is unreasonable? No, but they have a duty to inquire the qualifications on those whom they later do decide to rely on, something the court found that Wadsworth did not do. The Wadsworth offered no explanation, the court says, for their reliance upon Mr. Rothstein and Mr. Huff in spite of their longtime preparer, Mr. Borges' refusal to amend the returns. They also failed to establish that Mr. Huff and Mr. Rothstein were competent professionals with sufficient expertise to justify their reliance. Mr. Rothstein never testified. Mr. Huff did. Mr. Huff does not appear to have a background in tax, and he offered no legal authority to explain why he amended the return other than Mr. Rothstein directed him to do so. Since Mr. Rothstein doesn't testify, the court is stuck with Mr. Huff, and Mr. Huff seems to say simply, the attorney told me to do it. The attorney who isn't testifying in the case. The court found as well the taxpayers themselves gave no real justification, finding that the only explanation appears to be they went with the guy that gave them the lowest tax. that causes the court to decide that there was no reasonable reliance on a professional. As well, the court also tends to consider the taxpayer's own level of sophistication. And in this case, that worked against the Wadsworth. Petitioner is a successful businessman who, as a partner of GCMS, operated a multi-million dollar business. It is reasonable to assume that such a person would investigate the basis for amending his returns when his longtime accountant advised against the position taken on those returns. Petitioner's decision to amend their returns appears to have been motivated not by the demands of the law, but by their desire for tax refunds. That last sentence is the most telling. The court seems to have decided here that what we had was a taxpayer who was opinion shopping for preparers, and the primary qualification they were looking for was someone who would take the position they wanted, rather than seeking advice on what was a proper position under the law, the way a taxpayer should approach this if they want to have reasonable reliance on a professional. When taxpayers use result-oriented criteria in selecting an advisor, they aren't going to be allowed later to claim they relied on the of that advisor, when it seemed as if the main qualification for being the advisor for the taxpayer was taking the position the taxpayers wanted. Now, this particular case gives us some interesting points to consider. First, consider the fact that the CPA in question clearly did lose the client. That is, the client went elsewhere. That's normally the threat that you're faced with if you're trying to take a position the client doesn't want you to take, or if you won't take a position the client seriously wants taken on the return. They will tell you that somebody else will do it, and they may go get that somebody else. I suspect at this point in time, Mr. Borges may not be terribly disappointed that, in fact, they went and had somebody else amend the returns. It's not his problem now, it's theirs that they're facing, and it's not his potential liability now for not having advised the client that this wouldn't work. Secondly, it's important that clients understand that they have a responsibility, and they have a responsibility to judge the competency of professionals if they want to rely upon that. We should communicate to our clients, and especially in a case like this where we're not going to take a position that perhaps even another professional is telling the clients they can take, that the client's going to have to decide, because if this comes down to exam and it's clear that I said no, this is not an acceptable position, another advisor says yes it is, if the only reason you're choosing between us is you're going with the guy that says yes, that's not going to be considered a reasonable justification. You have to inquire further rather than merely accepting the answer you want. This has been the Tax Update for July the 28th, 2008. The Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Be sure to consider subscribing to their newsletters for information of interest to tax professionals. This has been the Tax Update.